Hello and welcome to History Hacks, another World War II one for you today. But with a difference, because Alina's been stalking people. And Alina, who have you found and dragged onto the podcast?
So we have two people with us today. First is Tracy Spate, who is a director of special projects at Wargaming Net, a publisher and a leading game developer who also has a background in history. Our second guest is Andy Brockman, who is a conflict archaeologist and investigative researcher. He's the editor of the Pipeline blog and has recently published a book with Tracy Spate called The Spitfires of Burma, a Fake History, which is out right now. And today we're going to talk about exactly that.
Hi guys, how are you doing? Tracy, you're in Cyprus. I didn't ask you where you were, Andy.
I'm actually in sunny Woolwich, southeast London.
Oh, how is lockdown? Have you had enough now? I'm in a very whingy place this week with it
I
all.
think everybody's having a very weird time, aren't they? It's as though we're in one of those sort of Tralfamadorian zoos from science fiction, where this artificial world's been created by the aliens for us all to live in. But no, we're thankfully, I can only hope that the people that listen to this have had haven't had to deal with the things that too many people have had to deal with. We've been very lucky so far, and we haven't been touched by the pandemic. So apart from the inconvenience of having to live at home with one's loved ones all the time, but we're okay, thank you.
Tracy, how about you, Cyprus? At least you're warm.
Well, yeah, life in the bunker is not so bad. I mean, have books to read, and we have a little courtyard with lemon trees and a thriving garden. So it's been nice spending more time at home and a little more leisure reading than I was used to. I miss the water cooler discussions with all my great colleagues at Wargaming, but otherwise, we're an online company anyway, so we're sort of used to working remotely, or as long as I got a laptop and my cell phone, I can do most things.
So start then by telling us about this legend of the buried Spitfires of Burma.
Well, shall I start? It really came to public notice in March of 2012 when David Cameron went to Myanmar as the representative, really, of the European Union at that point. Myanmar was opening up like a really a sort of butterfly after years of military dictatorship, and Aung San Suu Kyi had just been released from house arrest and was the leading politician in the country without yet being the effectively the head of state. And it was a very hopeful period. And at this point, David Cundall, who was a farmer from Lincolnshire, and a man called Steve Boultby Brooks, who runs the Boultby Spitfire Academy down in Sussex, by some combination of contacts, persuaded the Foreign Office and Cameron's Cabinet Office that this was a project, the search for buried Spitfires in Yangon International Airport, which had been an RAF base during World War II, was a goer. And so Cameron apparently had a negotiation with Thaksin Shinawatra, who was the president of Myanmar at the time, and they agreed on a joint heritage project to recover these legendary aircraft, which David had been chasing for the previous 20 years, it now turns out. And it became a worldwide story when it was reported in the by the press pack that was traveling with Cameron, and at which point Tracy came in on comes in because you picked up in the States, didn't you?
Yeah, that's right. I was in the San Francisco Bay Area at the time, and I was engaged in several heritage projects. We've just been working with USS Iowa, which becomes the Pacific Battleship Center at Pier 87 in LA. And I was looking at, okay, what projects might we work on next? And this came across my desk in April of 2012. I read that the British Prime Minister, David Cameron, had negotiated this agreement with the President of Myanmar to recover and repatriate these lost Spitfire aircraft. And I thought, wow, this is an incredible story. Wouldn't that be amazing if this is true? And I read articles in The Telegraph, The Guardian, the BBC. It received quite a lot of news coverage. So at that point, didn't have a strong basis for doubting it. I mean, after all, surely somebody at 10 Downing Street had checked out the story, or the BBC. And yet they were all describing it as, yes, these things were left there at the end of the war at Mingledon airfield and so on. I'll just plow ahead a bit. So I got in touch with David Kundle and found out that he and Steve Boultby Brooks had basically had a falling out. So there was an opening, and I thought, well, why don't you come out, visit us in San Francisco? So I sent him a ticket and brought him out to our office, and we met with David. He brought a big stack of documents with him, letters from veterans, talking about things that they had seen or heard about Spitfires being dumped or buried at the time. It was all quite convincing. David is a very good storyteller, is a very kind of salt of the earth figure, and has, a good persona about this. At the time, we thought, well, it might be true. We might dig a hole and find these lost aircraft. That would be just an amazing story. Or we might dig a big hole and they've all rusted or rotted away and there's nothing there. Or it'll be like that episode of the Geraldo where they opened Al Capone's vault on live TV and there was nothing inside. So we were aware these were all possibilities. But we thought, you know, it's not very much money. It's we'll go have a look and see. We'll see if it's possible to even get this contract for David to be allowed to proceed with an excavation or surveys and boreholes and whatnot. So it was just kind of like a, let's see if there's something to this when we initially got involved.
What kind of evidence did David have that these Spitfires existed?
Well, he showed us two different geophysical scans of parts of the airfield, which were indicative of buried metal, according to the resistivity measurements and so on. He had a whole bunch of letters from various veterans who had responded to advertisements. He had put in things like Fly Past Magazine, asking veterans who had served at RAF Mingledon to recount what they had seen or heard. He had shipping manifests recording the passage of aircraft brought by ship to Calcutta and other places. And assembled together, it told a fairly compelling story. I think at that time, we didn't have enough of a sense of exactly what we were looking at. We are not experienced in geophysics or understanding these plots and so on. But David told a good story when we saw these things. So I think we had enough sense to know that it could go different ways. It could be a shaggy dog story, or there might be a kernel of truth to this. And maybe even if the exact account isn't correct, maybe there's something there.
Sandy, how do you get dragged into all of this? Because it's actually quite an interesting story.
It is a story that couldn't have happened. The project couldn't have happened without the platform that we're using now, modern, you know, social media and video conferencing and so on. Essentially what happened was while Tracy's trying to put this project together from the Bay Area of California, I'm sat here in London as a conflict archaeologist being rung up by one of my colleagues to say, have you seen what's broken on the in the press? And I looked at the story, looked at the same coverage Tracy did, and my sort of conflict archaeology antennae started twitching, because I think, wait a minute, I've heard this kind of story before from lots of other different places, usually involving a high-end piece of kit, like a Tiger tank, or there's the legendary Sterling bomber that's missing in a hangar in Siberia, and so on. You know, people in this game, we hear these stories quite regularly. But this one, having attracted the attention of the Prime Minister, okay, this is more interesting than most. This has got more legs than most. So let's have a look at it. And I ended up writing an article for Marcus Milligan's Heritage Daily, and saying basically, yeah, this is a weird story. We've heard stories like this before. There are lots of inconsistencies, but it's worth looking at, firstly, as an example of the kind of folklore that grows up from World War II. But secondly, also, if there's the slightest possibility it's true, then it needs to be looked at archaeologically and recorded archaeologically, because it's so remarkable that just lambing him with a JCB, the big yellow trowel, wouldn't be appropriate. So I put that out there, and then it was picked up by the production company in New York, which Tracy had engaged for Wargaming to make a documentary about the project. So yeah, we're now working in three time zones: Myanmar, London, and California. Well, four actually, because New York and California are on different time zones in the States. So you know, it's becoming a major international project, and almost from without anybody intending that to be the case from the start.
Tracy, so what was going on in New York?
Well, actually, I brought them out from New York. So I knew John Halperin and Mark Minucci and those guys from, they were formerly at National Geographic, and I'd worked with the CFO at National Geographic for a few years before that. And so I thought, okay, well, the most interesting part of this is going to be the story. And whatever happens, if we don't record the beginning of it, then we can't exactly go back in time and try and capture it later. So we took a risk, and I thought, okay, well, we'll bring them out, and we'll do some filming, and we have to capture the beginning of this process of trying to get the contracts going into a country that's been closed off for, well, most of the last several decades, more or less, to capture the story as it's happening on the ground. And in the course of the interviews that we had filmed with David while we were in Myanmar, we started running into inconsistencies that didn't quite jive. And that led us to, okay, Seabees, does he mean the construction battalions from the U.S. Army that were operating in the far north of the country? Does he mean the Seabees, like, they sound the same, but it's different. The Seabees from the Navy who were building all of the PSP-based runways across the South Pacific, because they were involved in his version of the story of how the things were buried. So we ended up doing a bunch of digging in U.S. archives where these things are stored. And we kept finding, no, they were never at Mingledon, which in the course of doing some of this digging and researching, we run across Andy Brockman's article, and none of us had ever heard of conflict archaeology. We didn't know what that was, but we quickly realized that Andy had a deeper expertise in how to work in 20th century military archives that, well, I'm an 18th century historian, so things were a bit different in that day. So we realized we needed this kind of expertise to help us. And that led to my commissioning Andy to come in and write a proper desktop study to evaluate all the evidence that we did have.
So then you guys decide that you're going to start filming. And Tracy, you first head to Leeds to interview two academics who were involved with David on previous excavations. Can you tell us a bit more about that and what happens?
Right. Okay. I think you mean the geophysicists, Dr. Adam Booth and Dr. Roger Clark.
Yes.
Who are associated with Leeds University. Adam is now teaching in London, I think. Adam had been a grad student at the time that David had first phoned him up. David is based in Lincolnshire, and so is the University of Leeds. And David would call them up and say, hey, you know, I've heard about this crash Spitfire or hurricane or whatnot. And over the years through the 90s and 2000s, he was often involved in excavating various crash sites across the UK. So they had some experience working with them, and David had successfully found and recovered some aircraft in the past, which is, you know, partly which gave his story for us some credibility. On this occasion, though, he had called up Adam Booth and Roger Clark and said, hey, I want to go to Burma. And at first they thought he was saying something like Birmingham, not Burma. And he's like, no, I really, I mean Myanmar. I want to go to the other side of the world and check out this site where I believe there's some buried Spitfires. And they thought, well, okay, the crazier things have happened in war, but we have the equipment and the expertise. And if we can help out, why not? It would be interesting. And so Adam had gone out with David on that expedition in 2004 and done a survey of the sort of target area where David said the witnesses had seen or heard things about aircraft being disposed of or buried.
At this point, we're all working with David's version of the story, mm-hmm. though we're adding more and more documentary material afterwards. The crucial thing about Adam Booth's work, as Tracy said, Adam was a grad student at University of Leeds in 2004. He goes out to Myanmar to help out David. He's on his own, and he's told to survey a particular area where David says things are happening. Mm-hmm. There is a metallic return there. It's in Adam's geophysics plots. They get a 360 in. They put a hole in the ground. They hit some timbers, and then there has been a power struggle in the Myanmar government at exactly this moment. And the person who's the patron of the project, we subsequently found out, basically became an unperson under house arrest. And they were escorted from the site at gunpoint. So there was this huge cliffhanger, we were told.
Yeah. The crunch of wood as the digger bucket just started the dig, and then it was halted and everyone was escorted off.
Absolutely. So in storytelling terms, there's this huge narrative hook to take the story on further. And so that's effectively what we were preparing to do once the licenses have been agreed and permissions have been agreed between the Wargaming and David and the Myanmar government in the autumn of 2012.
And the Myanmar partner of David, the STP or Sui Tong Kor, that process took us all summer and into the fall. So it wasn't even clear if this was going to go anywhere until it was formally signed in late October of 2012. So until that point, it was kind of it was placing a poker chip down to see, well, this would be really cool if we had the opportunity to do it, but it wasn't at all clear that it would proceed at all. I mean, after all, it's occurring in Myanmar, which was just opening up to the world, and this is their only international airport, and we were proposing to dig a big hole next to the active runway, which made certain parties in the government uneasy. We had to convince seven different ministries to allow us to proceed.
Wow. So in the... Tracy, you carry on filming interviews and meeting various people, especially veterans. Mm-hmm. How do these meetings go, especially with Major Roger Browning? Is this the point where your views begin to change?
Well, okay. I met Major Roger Browning on November 11, 2012 at the, Taiyokian Cemetery that's just outside of Yangon, where they commemorate British and Commonwealth forces that had perished in the fighting. And it was quite extraordinary. They had members of the Burmese Rifles. Several British soldiers had flown over. It was quite an assemblage. And there were ambassadors, diplomatic corps, military attachés, and representatives from all these governments come together to give speeches, lay wreaths at this cemetery. And while I was there, I ran into Major Roger Browning, and it turned out that he had been the officer in charge of the 652nd Mechanical Unit, which was responsible for extending the runway at Mingledon at the end of the war. And I thought, well, surely if anybody's going to know about burials, it would be somebody like this. And in our conversation, he said, well, no, I have no recollection of an operation like that, and I'm sure I would have known. He did allow that, well, there could have been disposal of shot up airframes or other kind of material bulldozed at the end of the war to convert it for civilian use. He said, well, that's possible. But he was pretty doubtful of David's idea that Spitfires have been created and left there deliberately. He didn't put much stock in that. And then Andy would subsequently interview him back in the UK. I met him in Myanmar, and then Andy would interview him in the UK later.
We also ought to mention Group Captain Maurice Shaw, who actually came to us.
Serendipity.
but serendipitously, and actually in research terms, very helpfully untainted by having had his testimony interpreted through David Cundall, which our other principal witness, later Corporal Stanley Coombe had, who we also had the pleasure and privilege of meeting and working with. But Maurice had a very long career in the Royal Air Force, but it began really in Burma with an RAF engineering unit on Mingledon in the autumn of 45. But he said he'd not seen anything such as David described while he was actually stationed there. Certainly hadn't seen any Americans. Although he worked with Americans in the up country. But when he was later posted to Singapore, chatting to people who followed him on from England or later, there were stories that Spitfires had been dumped, disposed of, buried, sunk in swamps. The stories vary. And to put the rest of the witness testimony just in perspective, this testimony is from relates to the autumn and winter of 1945, when there appears to be service gossip that something odd is going on with Spitfires at Mingledon, and the accounts vary, but nobody has actually seen anything. There's no photographs, there's no documents. And then in the following spring, Stanley Coombe, who has been training in India for the invasion of Malaya, which then doesn't happen in full force, it becomes a live fire exercise, and he ends up in crossing over Mingledon airfield in an army truck on a new posting around April 1946, when he's just celebrated his 21st birthday. He sticks that in his head. He then says that he saw crates next to the runway where it was being worked on, by the road that his truck was travelling on. And then the following day, he doesn't see anything happening. The crates aren't open. He doesn't know what's in them. The following day, he's working the other side of the airfield, which is this big flat griddle place of clay, basically, above Rangoon, as well as Yangon, as is now. And he looks across the airfield, and he can still see the crates. There's a part that these crates piled up, what being dealt with. It happens to be the engineering section of the airfield, we now know from the other documents, where the main engineering dispersal was. And he asks an RAF ERC who's there. So you've got an army corporal and an RAF ERC, and he says, what's in those crates over there? And he, as Stanley told it, the RAF guy says, well, would you believe it, mate, they're Spitfires. And that is the extent of the checkable witness statements. Everything else that we've seen, we can maybe discuss later about how to, you know, how you use research with quotes witnesses, and the importance of it, but also the pitfalls that it can lead you into if you don't do the normal checks and balances.
It's all feeling a bit ropey, isn't it, at this point?
it's about to get better. It's about to get much better.
Go on.
Because Andy then takes part with Tracy in a press conference at the Imperial War Museum in November 2012. And I think we're going to start with Andy, because Tracy can tell us what it all looked like afterwards.
Okay, so what is happening in the run-up to the press conference is that we have recognised that David is a born storyteller, but he has he doesn't possess an edit button, and so any modern high-profile project that's about to go into a press conference, we the day before we're doing a media prep session in a hotel in just off the city, and we've come up with a framing device which allows everybody to be able to leave with dignity if the Spitfires aren't there. And basically what we've agreed is that we're going to do a CSI Yangon, a crime scene investigation, where we've got an alleged missing person, but we don't even know if they are actually genuinely missing by now, because there's nothing in the documents or anyone else that suggests this happened. So we're wanting to try and chase the story through. And to their credit, Wargaming stuck with it. Even though they had this heads up that almost certainly these aeroplanes aren't there, and almost certainly it's a modern myth. But they decided to stick with the project, to continue to fund it, and to do the field work. So that in the end, if we'd have just said, no, don't believe it, evidence doesn't stack up, all the true believers will say, ah, yeah, but you didn't dig any holes, so how do you know? Of course they're there, it's part of the cover-up, you know, because again, there's this smoke screen of innuendo that the British government is somehow incredibly embarrassed by what happened, because it deals with still living members of the members of the royal family and potentially still living on, you know, military officers, secret service people and so on, that there's still a cover-up going on at top level in Whitehall to prevent this story coming out. Basically because it was about interference in the internal politics of Burma, as was pitting the Burman majority against the Karen people, the Hill people, who had been close allies of Britain, British, and particularly the SOE during World War II. So there's this sort of slightly spooky secret squirrel aspect as well that we're needing to deal with. So basically, we agreed at the press conference that we present it as a CSI, that we'd introduce the team who were going to be doing the field work, and we'd say we were going into it with a completely open mind, with no preconceptions. We were going to follow the evidence wherever the evidence took it, and then report it openly. At which point, it was all going very nicely, and then David started giving interviews saying that there were 12, 24, 36 or more Spitfires, depending on who he was talking to at the time. And
buried so, on the orders of Lord Louis Mountbatten of Southeast Japan as part of the secret operation.
I have to say that you guys are on camera and Tracy is chuckling his way through this. That you've got a sense of humor about it. It makes you a bigger person than I would have been in this scenario.
Well, you can laugh or cry, and you never
you guys,
know
go on, sorry.
Where you might end up.
You guys fly to Burma. That's where you end up in January 2013, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So tell us about that.
Okay, so again, because Wargame wanted to do this properly by the archaeology, we'd gone through the usual process of desktop research. We then wrote an extensive project design, safety briefs, how we deal with UXO, how we deal with human remains if we found human remains. And of course, remembering that the RAF Mingledon was effectively fought over twice during World War II and actively bombed for much of the rest of the war. So it was highly likely that we would find a lot of conflict archaeology and potentially unexploded ordnance and human remains. So all of that was covered. We had a detailed project design. We had an expert plant operator to work with us because we were using, the standard fieldwork techniques of doing surface strip and then bucket excavation until we need to take over by hand. And we'd recruited to go with our geophysicists from University of Leeds, Andy Merritt, Adam Booth, who actually at that point was actually at Imperial in London, but anyway. Adam Booth and Andy Merritt to work with them and to give effect to the geophysics. We had a field director, Martin Brown, from the No Man's Land Project, probably one of the country's most experienced conflict archaeologists, and who I'd first worked with on a time team a few years earlier, and also another No Man's Land colleague, Rod Scott, who, as well as being a qualified archaeologist, is also a military EOD operator and a specialist in period ordnance. So could they both keep you safe and interpret what you find? So treating that kind of material as part of the finds assemblage, so absolutely crucial in conflict archaeology on what had been an active conflict site in the 20th century. So we were fully prepped to do this. And we arrived there, we put in place a complete new geophysics survey so we can compare it with the 2004 work that Adam had already done, plus two other companies that David had commissioned. And we begin on the basis of that to work at a location which David had identified in 2004, where those timbers had been found. And where David again repeated to us that, yep, this is where I believe they are. And this is where we found the timbers in 2004, but we were stopped. We weren't allowed to go any further. What happens then though, is that we look, the first big machine trench on that location, Martin and Manny, who the machine operator, both of them said, Manny Mercado, who sadly died recently, but terrific guy and terrific, he's one of those people who could use the bucket of a JCB like a trowel. Brilliant, brilliant man. Between them, what they worked out was the ground had been turned over at least once before. And proof of that, both in the tip lines, but also the fact that there was a polythene carrier bag in the spoil, came out in the spoil. And then we get We get down to about 2.5 meters, and we hit blue clay natural, and the hole starts to flood. Now, if you're an RAF engineer and your boss says to you in 1945, I want you to bury some Spitfires there 30 feet down, which is what David was claiming, and you hit blue natural at 2.5 meters, so what's that, about 8-9 feet, and it's very, very wet, you're going to say, actually, that's not a really good idea, boss. So I think you should think of something else to do with these aeroplanes. You know, fly them to India and then we can fly them back again if we want to give them to the Karen. It's just not, the physical environment really makes the story not tenable.
Yeah.
What do you guys actually find?
Apart from a carrier bag and
you do find something. So yes. What is it that you find?
Yeah,
I'll let Andy speak to the archaeology, and then I'll talk about the other things.
Yeah, don't forget, we're doing this archaeology. We've got regular visits from convoys of black SUVs with military policemen on the back, and
fully armed,
immaculately dressed Myanmar Tatmadaw senior officers. And government ministers, and remembering at this time the military and the government are virtually interchangeable. And obviously our partners at STP who have a lot at stake in this, and we're very conscious of that. When that first hole came up with a very strong negative, we looked again at the geophysics and said, okay, we need to locate the Prome Road which Stanley Coombe had been driving on. That morning, that day when he said he saw the crates, because we could then prove the geography and we could give a good indication of where those crates might have been. And cut to the chase, we did several more trenches, extensive machine trenches, which were then looked at and recorded archaeologically. We found evidence of repeated episodes of flooding on that particular part of the airfield. The natural where it hadn't been disturbed was within 2-3 meters of the modern surface. There were elements of the 1940s concrete runways that were built after the war, still in situ. Look, most of it had been ripped out, but when the runway was realigned in the 1950s, but there were still elements of that architecture there, which proved something, and again proved that something that had been claimed had happened couldn't have happened, because there was also a claim that the land surface had been built up by many feet since the war. In all the parts of the airfield we looked at, that's just not true. You can actually see the landscape of 1940s very close to the modern surface. Even when there are modern buildings, modern runways, modern hardstands over the top, you can still work out the principal alignment of the main 1945 runway. Parts of it are even still in use by the Myanmar military. So we were able to prove the conflict landscape, and in fact we did find what appeared to be the bed, at least, of a road in the right place according to the air photographs to have been the Prome Road that Stanley's army truck had been on. And next to that was a slit trench which had been backfilled with sandbags, which again is entirely appropriate for the kind of thing that would have happened during World War II while the airfield was under military use and military occupation, because there would have been slit trenches all over the place for the either defensive or shelters. We found conflict archaeology. There was a very limited number of finds, very small piece of PCP, pistol plank, which we know was used to surface the runways and the hard stands, particularly during the monsoon season. But it's not surprising there wasn't much of that left, because if you go to Yangon nowadays, most people have got it in their garden fences. It's been reused all over the place, repurposed as often as fencing material. We also found some engineering bricks. We worked out, we found out afterwards where they probably came from. or what they probably came from, and also one very large but unidentifiable bolt that we reckon from the quality of the steel was probably part of an aeroplane at one time, but we weren't able to identify what part of an aeroplane. So we, you know, we've under very strange conditions and with a lot of politics going on around, we have actually managed to recover, I think, enough archaeology to make a reasonable thesis about what had actually gone on there archaeologically.
How does the media react?
I think
I should say at the time. Well, just to put Tracy, as Tracy, I mean, this was more Tracy's department, but just to put it in the picture. One of the weird things, like I talked about time zones earlier, we're coming down to breakfast and we're looking at, for example, the stories that have been published in London in the papers and we discover that, for example, there are unofficial briefings going on. So Tracy, from the point of view trying to run the project, is both trying to deal with the diplomatic side, but also firefighting this constant dialogue with the media, which, again, there are lots of assumptions going on and lots of positions are being made, being placed.
Yeah, I guess you could say, I mean, to look back at what we did at the Imperial War Museum back in November of 2012, we tried to frame this as an episode of CSI Burma, if you will, where we wanted David to back away from his more speculative statements about, you know, Lord Louis Mountbatten running a secret parallel operation with Sir Keith Park or others to hide planes for the benefit of the Karen.
Let's just
stick with what you have heard and from these veterans who were there at the time who recall seeing or hearing things and, you know, where they saw them. Let's focus on that. My own thinking at this point is, look, if there is some truth behind this legend, then perhaps as part of the post-war cleanup of the airfield, a bunch of stuff was dumped. Because as Andy finds in the... as part of the desktop study, we know that more than 100 planes were broken up in situ on the airfield. There's a report from the commander at the time saying that these things are being broken up and then taking the sheets of aluminum off of the planes and turning them into cooking pots and utensils for the local population, many of whom had lost all this stuff during the occupation of the Japanese army. And so I thought there was some basis that, well, we may find some scrapped or shot up or, you know, broken pieces of planes. And that would still be a pretty interesting story. But David just couldn't help himself with the press. And it was like playing the tape. We would hear about this story and the number of airplanes that he believes were buried. And the media gravitated towards that narrative much more than the CSI framing that we tried to put in place at the beginning of the project. So for them, this is a story about triumph or failure, whether he finds the planes or not finds the planes. That's the story for them. And it proved very difficult to tell any other kind of story.
So the funding is then pulled. You stop digging and pretty much just leave. So what happens after that?
Well, we didn't quite just leave. We were very conscious of the position that STP, the local Myanmar company, would be in. So I made sure that there were sufficient funds to close up the site properly, do remediation and grading and fill in all the trenches, all of that sort of thing we covered. And I also provided a little bit of funds for David to go up off to Michina, chasing another one of his theories about planes being buried up there, as a way to help STP have a soft landing from this very visible in the media project. I didn't want to leave them twisting in the wind, in other words. And so we did take care to close down everything properly.
We were very conscious of that as a team, because particularly as representatives of the former colonial power, we were very clear that we didn't want this to be seen as somehow these, you know, these white British people parachuting into Myanmar to do this thing to the people of Myanmar and then clearing away again with the glory. One of the things that we were very clear about doing the archaeology, and it's in the project designs, that is that we would deal with the archaeology of any period and any culture equally. So, for example, if there were, if there were Spitfires there, but you know, they cut into an earlier structure of the native Burman cultures or whatever, they would be recorded equally. And if that took more time, so be it. You know, it wasn't just a smash and grab raid on behalf of some British Spitfire enthusiasts.
So do you want to cover leaving then? How you got out?
Well, I mean,
by regular scheduled flights.
We had a set amount of time. Yeah. I mean, the geophysicists had to go back for the start of the semester. So there was a very clear bookend at the beginning of this project. We couldn't all just go there indefinitely. We had other commitments and responsibilities. So it was clear at the start, we would have a maximum of about 2.5 or 3 weeks to do this project. It had to fit in that window.
Having said that, had the Spitfires been there, it could have been extended. So, you know, obviously.
Yeah, we would have found a way. We would have brought in the people and so forth. But that was sufficient time to basically go and ground truth this story.
And David, in fact, stayed on. He, as Tracy said, he did go to mission, or although we told him and STP that according to the documents in London at Kew, at the National Archive and elsewhere, there was no evidence that the RAF had even been active in a major way at mission. Or it was an American base once the town was recaptured in 1944. So we basically finished our time limited part of the project. We returned to our day jobs and so on, and are preparing to write the reports of what we've done, because that again was part of the bargain. You know, we would report everything openly, good, bad, and indifferent. And so that's what happens while David carries on and eventually finds another sponsor and has one more attempt at digging with that sponsor's support.
Well, he was digging in 2013 after we left, then again in 2014, and then I'm not really clear how many other digs may or may have happened after that. But we, though, gave a public lecture at RAF
Museum.
Were we at Cosfield?
Or? The RAF Museum.
Oh, that's right, at the RAF Museum. We gave a public lecture on what we had found. And then subsequently, we turned that into a 200-page report on the archaeology and geophysics of the site, which we also put out in the public domain.
Which it's fair to say that the people who believe in the Spitfire legends think is full of errors and is part of the cover-up. So,
I mean, it's still not stopped, has it? It's still continuing until now, this whole argument.
Oh, the argument continues. In fact, they had to shut it down on the aviation forums after they had passed 5,000 posts and more than 1 million views, where I think in the book we put it like, the proprietor is sort of like the owner of a pub that decides it's time to close the doors and take all the kind of inebriated customers out and just say, you know, good night. So they shut that argument down after about 3 years, since basically one faction was challenging the competence and veracity of our work, and it just became very conspiratorial and strange. The goalposts.
It was an exercise. I liken it to a combination between moving the goalposts in a game of whack-a-mole, because every time we came up with an evidence-based explanation for what had been going on, the goalposts would move and what aboutery would happen.
History and whack-a-mole, we love it on History House.
Yeah, exactly. And this is one of the reasons we wanted to write the book, actually, because it's a textbook example of how these stories develop and perpetuate themselves, and how, in fact, you know, as historians and archaeologists, we have to engage with them, because, you know, we have a responsibility to the evidence and the lived history and the, whatever the as close to an objective story, truth, narrative, whatever you want to call it. We have a responsibility to that. But at the same time, these are fascinating parts of popular culture too. And we can't condemn them absolutely unless they're misused by bad actors, as we see in other, in other historical narratives. This is a pretty benign one. It hasn't hurt anybody. The only thing that's been hurt is bank accounts.
Yeah.
And maybe a few reputations. But, it's now, it remains a living part of the folklore of World War II in the Far East. It will continue to be that. Nothing we say or do is going to change that. And in fact, I was saying to Tracy just the other day, after we did one of these interviews, talks about when we were talking about the book, somebody commented underneath the recording, I prefer to believe David rather than your cynicism.
Oh, wow.
If it makes you happy. Yes. Does David still stand behind all of the stuff he was saying at the time?
I mean, Tracy, you said you've had more contact with
him. You said he couldn't help himself with things like the Mountbatten link. And does he continue to have the same opinion?
Well, the last time I'd exchanged emails and had a phone conversation, I think he's still a believer that these planes are out there and that we had simply dug in the wrong place.
And there's at least one other of his supporters as well who still believes that there will be big chunks of Spitfire there. And we never said there wouldn't be. We never said, looking at precedents, there was the Spitfire wing that turned up on Orkney a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. These things do happen, but just not in the way that David's version of the legend describes, I think it's fair to say, so far.
Heart ruling head, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, we're very clear in the book that we're not blaming anyone for this. We're not saying that anybody deliberately set out to dupe anybody. There may be an element of Shaggy Dog story about the original story that appears to have come out of the United States in the 1970s. Although, again, there's other possible reports that it was current again in the 1950s after that initial flurry in 1945, 1946. But, it wasn't... again, we have to believe David and the people who support him, they do genuinely love these aircraft as artifacts. That the existence of these artifacts is really important to them. The continued existence of these artifacts is really important to them. And, Tracy, you've worked with lots of museums and you've met, again, people who spend vast amounts of money curating these things. And
I've been out to the late Paul Allen's collection, the Flying Heritage Collection in Oregon. And these things are lovingly restored and maintained, both aircraft and tanks, to a standard that's almost unbelievable. They look like they just came off the assembly line. What I found extraordinary as an American coming into this project, I remember when we were filming at Duxford during an air show and they were flying Spitfires overhead. And I just watched the audience and you could see all the British people stand a little taller and straighter as the planes would swoop down into view. I learned all about Spitfire ale and the wonderful ad campaign behind that and found it hilarious, or even the way that the Spitfire is commemorated in the, I forgot the name of the abbey, where there's a stained glass window with the Spitfire.
Bentley Priory.
Bentley Priory. So I visited that as well. And we don't have anything quite like that in American culture around the Second World War. We like our P-51s and stuff, but they're not an iconic thing the way that the Spitfire is. So that was quite revelatory in doing this project.
Guys, this has been absolutely fascinating. And there's obviously lots more to this story as well if people are hooked on it. So tell people, what's the book called and where can they get it?
Okay, the book is called The Buried Spitfires of Burma, A Fake History. It is available from all good online sources. If you're in the UK or anywhere else where bookshops are opening up at the moment after lockdown, please support your local bookshop. We need them.
Absolutely.
Wherever you buy it from, it's available in hardback from the History Press. Very Spitfires of Burma, yep. Fake history.
Looks like this.
Good artwork.
Amazing. Yeah. Thank you so much, guys, for coming and talking to us about Burma, the Spitfires, the interesting... my mind's gone completely blank now.
This is our first show on fake history, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which I really like, but not fake as in vindictively fake, but turned out to be in this case. But it's our first show on what goes wrong, what can go wrong.
And we're definitely going to have to get Andy back on, because I know he's got a couple of others under his sleeve.
Definitely.
Join us tomorrow when Lawrence Owen will be with us to talk about mummies. And that's not the lovely kind that cook for you and do your washing. That's actual wrapped up in bandages and smelling bad mummies. That one's great, so don't miss it.
Don't forget, you can become a patron of History Hack for as little as $1 a month. Just go to www.historyhack.podbean.com. It will help us keep going in the aftermath of the coronavirus, and we would really appreciate it, as we would love to do so. There now follows a public service announcement.
I'm Horatio Hornblower.
And I'm Archie Kennedy. The simplest gift you can give in these troubled times is to obey orders.
Indeed. The regulations are very clear in the matter. It is the duty of all of us to remain at anchor until the little people in the talking box signal you otherwise.
You don't want to end up getting flogged.
Good day to you.
Good day to you both.